Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Consider these facts. 96% of the mass of mammals on our planet today are us and the livestock that we've domesticated. Only 4% is everything else, from elephants to badgers, tigers to bats. 70% of all birds are now domesticated poultry, mostly chickens. Nature once determined how we survive. Now we determine how nature survives.
It's the scripting as well, isn't it? It's just incredible. The unmistakable voice of David Attenborough. Now, on his 99th birthday, he marked the occasion with the release of Ocean, his latest documentary. The film is a powerful call to action, shining a light on the fragility of our oceans and urging urgent global efforts to protect them in the battle against climate change. But Ocean is just the latest chapter in a remarkable legacy. Over a lifetime of storytelling, David Attenborough has brought the natural world right into our homes, introducing us to extraordinary creatures, lost civilizations, and the breathtaking beauty of our planet, all while deepening our understanding of what's at stake. Well, joining me now to talk about his phenomenal career in nature is Kevin O'Sullivan, environment and science editor with the Irish Times, and Ken O'Sullivan, underwater cameraman and filmmaker. No relation, we should say, from the outset. Kevin, from a scientific perspective, firstly, how significant do you think David Attenborough's impact has been?
I think it's been immense, really, and it's progressed over the years and built over the years. And I think he's just that he is rooted in science, and he is the most amazing naturalist. But he also has this ability to really make it accessible, to create the wow factor, and then to reveal the full extent of humans' impact on the most precious ecosystems across the entire planet. So Ocean, I think, is probably a great encapsulation of that life, but it's different to all the other series he's done. It has the same messaging in terms of going up close on nature, going up close on every aspect of the ocean, but it comes with a really strong political message at the end. And arguably, Attenborough became political. He just showed the wow factor in the early decades, and it was fantastic, and it was just amazing. Mm-hmm. But then he discovered, you know, nature loss and biodiversity, and then in the latter years, and it's only been the latter years that he's been really sending this strong message about climate change. And I think that's his lasting legacy, that he's really got political. He's not afraid to say, look, time is running out. We must do these things. We must protect a tiny fraction of the oceans that will have this amazing impact. And that's the really positive thing that came out of Ocean, despite all the tragedy that was displayed on screen, that he had this message at the end. If we just protect what we say we're going to protect, then there's an opportunity to re-flourish. And I think that's the real big message that he still conveys today.
He talks very clearly as well about the impact of taking those actions. If you do what you should do, things turn around very quickly. That's that message of hope, isn't it, in Ocean?
It is. But the thing about it is he throws up the most amazing examples of it. Like, he showed how regeneration is happening off Hawaii, in the Channel Islands, off California, in Papua New Guinea, where the smallest degree of protection has an impact far beyond. Mm-hmm. And that's the really surprising message for me, that can be done despite all the damage, all the wreckage that we've done to the oceans. And he also reflects in this film the amazing destruction that humanity has done, particularly in terms of bottom trawling and scallop dredging, and, you know, harvesting far too much fish from the sea, particularly krill in Arctic zones. So, you know, it's a hard message as well, not just saying this is a wonderful world we have and we just need to mind it. It's much more than that.
Yes, it's based on the reality of what's happening. But Ken, if we look at his wider career then and go right back, I mean, he started, well, one of his early jobs was controller of BBC Two, wasn't it?
That's right. He started with the BBC Two, Claire, or BBC in 1952. And amazingly, people might not know this, as controller of BBC Two, he commissioned Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Aha.
Was responsible for the first colour TV broadcast. None of us here in this room remember colour, black and white TV. And they were looking at colour TV and thinking, well, what can we put out on this that really maximises colour? And one of the things they brought in was snooker. It was a series called Pot Black, which I remember as a kid, ran for 20 years. And I think it just shows the man was a visionary. And I can make the argument that he has actually influenced hurling. Because in the mid-1970s, he suggested quite strongly to Wimbledon that were they to use yellow tennis balls, that the viewers of colour TV might not be able to see things better. And of course, the GAA brought that into hurling a few years ago.
What colour were the balls before they became yellow?
White.
Wimbledon. White.
Yeah.
It makes total sense, doesn't it?
You don't
it?
Remember before the 1970s, no.
No, you've got... But, no, you're right there, actually. Absolutely. I don't. And I can't say that very often, that I don't remember things, but I don't remember before the 1970s. So I win on that one. For you then, Ken, what makes the storytelling so compelling? Because this is your business.
Yeah, look, I mean, he's just this wonderfully eccentric man in his earlier days. He's like this goofy schoolboy, you know, but grew into this kind of uncle, grandfather figure that puts his hand on your shoulder and you just want to listen to what he's saying. Hugely charismatic. Of course, his brother Richard Attenborough is probably one of Britain's most famous screen actors mm-hmm. as well. But a committed, passionate storyteller that just brings you with them. And then, as Kevin had said, I mean, you know, the BBC pretty much developed the notion of the natural history documentary, you know, back in the 1950s. I think it's interesting to see. So his first series was something called Zoo Quest. And they would have said that they were the first Europeans to go to places like Papua New Guinea. No, not to colonise and to rape and pillage, but what they were actually doing was kind of taking animals and insects and bringing them back to examine them as kind of a Victorian ethos. Now, over the years, we've seen that how that has developed hugely up as far as oceans now, where he's been a huge advocate for climate change. And I think he'd be the first to admit that the big BBC series, you know, Planet Earth 2 came out in, I think, 2016. And one of the BBC's top executives said, this is the greatest missed opportunity in the history of broadcasting. Why? Everything was amazing in the world. Everything was beautiful. But they addressed that and they have really...
But there was no mention of climate change.
Climate change, bad news stories. No, they did do that in certain things, certain TV programmes, but the big iconic natural history series like Planet Earth and until Blue Planet 2 came out in 2017. But, I mean, what can you say about the man? He retired 34 years ago, or he could have retired.
Yeah.
And everything that he has done since is, you know, more than most of us could do in our three lifetimes. So.
We talk, you know, when you talk about communication and broadcasting in particular, people mention authenticity, don't they? I mean, that is the story of David Attenborough, Kevin. It goes back to what you were saying. He's just deeply committed and interested in what he's doing.
Absolutely. And I think that gene is the strongest element of his output. And it's still evident at 99 years of age, which is truly remarkable. I think he's just aged a little in the last 5 years. But apart from that, his voice is still compelling. And he still has that beautiful gift of distilling, you know, what the essence of his message is without distorting the science. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's repeated 10 times over. I have a view of him. Well, obviously, Ken is in the filming, but I think his career matches the history of the camera, because the cameras have become more sophisticated. They become closer to, you know, what you're filming. They can film right up beside a finback whale or a tiny little krill. And he's used that technology in an incredible way to display that. And then, of course, in recent times, he's highlighting the nature loss issue, which I think probably is his great legacy. And I always believe that there's a coin, and one side is nature loss and biodiversity loss, and the other is climate change and climate disruption. And he is responsible more than most for highlighting the nature loss now in that final sort of decade of his career.
Did he influence you, Ken, in your
career
choice?
I think he's influenced anybody who's watched nature documentaries. And, you know, he's made them so popular. When Blue Planet 2 came out in 2017, it was the most watched TV programme in Britain. I mean, we talk about our Love Island or whatever, our sports or FA Cup. Most, so, you know, people just love this stuff. And as Kevin says, he has guided us from looking at the beauty of the nature to the huge conservation issues. And, you know, it's about education and awareness. I know Kevin was talking there about biodiversity loss, about climate change. There's another side of that, which I think he's now brought in, which is the idea of you know, the old idea that these things are polar opposites, that if you're going to farm or if you're going to fish commercially, that you're going to cause damage and we have to live with that, which of course is absolutely untrue. And now when he's showing things like how the ocean regenerates itself, how nature can, that of course fishing is important and farming, and that we can make these two things, that they're not mutually mm-hmm. exclusive. And there's any number of ocean projects. You mentioned marine protected areas. Absolutely, we need them in Ireland. Our politicians, where are they? Projects in the UK, the Sussex kelp recovery. You know, in 4 years they went from having nothing on the seabed to kind of fully regenerated and bringing back squid, cuttlefish, all of the biodiversity.
Well, let's come to your favourite moments now, because we asked you to pick some, which has been interesting. So Kevin, here's the clip of yours and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
Plastic has become an integral part of our daily lives, but every year some 8 million tonnes of it ends up in the ocean, and there it could be lethal.
Audiences across the country, glued to Blue Planet 2, have been starkly reminded of the problems of plastics pollution.
The problem was vividly highlighted in the BBC's recent Blue Planet 2 series, which was public service broadcasting at its finest. The plan for England, which we're publishing today, sets out the action of government.
We are at a unique stage in our history. Never before have we had such an awareness of what we are doing to the planet. And never before have we had the power to do something about that. Surely we have a responsibility to care for our blue planet. The future of humanity, and indeed all life on Earth, now depends on us.
Well, he said it there himself, didn't he? I mean, that was the moment really when we got it, when we realised what we were doing with plastic pollution to our oceans.
Yeah, I think that was the critical moment in terms of mass reaction across the planet, in terms of people being abhorred by what the scale of the pollution of plastic. And the images that really encapsulated that were sea turtles, giant mammals, tangled in plastic, ingesting plastic. It was very distressing. And I think particularly with young people, they said, you know, listen, why are we doing this? You know, why are we letting it happen? And I think it did have this cascading effect in terms of a response. And I think, you know, the really good things came out of it, like volunteerism, cleaning up coastlines, monitoring coastlines. And I think that's a great legacy. But it was really distressing to see how plastic had not only, you know, incorporated into the lives of these mammals, but also that it was found at the bottom of the deepest oceans, and it was almost totally everywhere, mm-hmm. and that's still the case. And unfortunately, that scenario has worsened because we now see how microplastics are occurring and are arising everywhere in diet, and not just the big chunks of plastic netting that are killing fish or whatever.
And in Ocean, which you watched, his most recent programme, that distress and the continuing pollution of the ocean, that's in there as well, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Now, it's probably... It's moved on in the sense that he comes back to the actual direct destruction of sea creatures, because I think, and he explained it very well, we don't see how trawling actually happens at the bottom of the ocean. And he has this incredible footage, I don't know how he got it, of these nets that run for 20 kilometres, 30 kilometres across the bed and just scar everything and take up everything with it, and then probably use 1% of the fish they find. And likewise with this dredging, where he had this incredible piercing sound of the dredger going along the bottom of the sea, ripping out everything before mm-hmm. it and after it. So, you know, that I think that was the overriding message for me, visually seeing how this destruction happens.
Now, Ken, we have a clip of your favourite moment, the description of that famous clip where David Attenborough shares some incredible one-on-one time with gorillas. Let's have a listen.
David, what was your recollection of this moment?
Oh, I suppose bliss, really.
Yeah, you look quite happy,
but
David.
You're grimacing.
Well, I was only grimacing. I mean, I'm grimacing because he's pulling my lips. One of them out of the shot there is pulling my foot. These baby gorillas started taking off my shoes. Well, you can't talk about the opposable thumb and the importance in primate evolution of the grip if somebody's taking off your shoes. Particularly if that somebody is, it's two baby gorillas. So I thought, well, this is...
Using their opposable thumb to undo your shoelace.
Can't actually do this. And so actually the notions of primate evolution and the technicalities of digital grips vanished.
Out the window.
Just sort of lay there while this extraordinary experience.
This was one of the amazing moments of that filming expedition where I had the expectation of getting David with a few gorillas in the background, and then to suddenly find he was surrounded by gorillas with youngsters sort of upending on him and sticking their bottoms in his face and biting his knee. Unbelievable.
That was certainly one of the most unforgettable moments of my career in making natural history films.
That brought you great joy, Ken, did it?
Not so much the bottoms in the face, no. But anyway, look, it's an iconic moment. It's actually, I think it's called Life on Planet Earth, 1979. Absolutely iconic because, you know, here was this man, you know, sitting with baby gorillas in his arms. You know, of course, we've learned in the meantime that we should let wild animals be wild animals. But it was just iconic as to how cool the man was in the thing and to tell the story of these animals. And a lot has changed since then. I think it was in the Congo. There was a great story, wasn't there, that the local police or the army thought they were spies and tried to take the film reels off them. And luckily the film cameraman was kind of wise to it, that they had put some blank reels into their bags, and I think they took the blank reels off them.
So we almost never
saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Professor Tim Lynch, who was in with us earlier, who's a neurologist, we were talking to him about Parkinson's disease. He's listening and got in touch to say that David Attenborough is a perfect example of healthy ageing because he remains curious and continues to be active intellectually and physically. So there are lessons for us all here, right?
Well, there you go. So at that point in time, in 1979, Claire, the man was 53. And I heard him saying that his children were reared and he thought, well, you know, I'm not going to just sit in an office for the rest of my life. So he went out and had an incredibly active, curious life, which, of course, very good for our brains and our outlook.
He was only getting started at that
point.
Only
getting started,
at 53, and you know, launching his latest documentary at 99. It's just incredible. But you would advise us to watch it anyway, Kevin?
Absolutely, and I think particularly for young people, it would reinforce the message that we are interconnected. Like, we're connected with everything around us, whether it's plants or animals, and it kind of explains why that is matters. And so if you damage one, you're damaging, you know, the ecosystem, you're damaging the human world as well, ultimately. So I think for that message alone, and then the way it's so convincing, it's like a grand opera initially, and the music and the drama and the voice, and that's all there. Now, the one sad thing about it is he says, you know, I'm coming to the end of my life, you know, so you know, that sort of rings in the background, but it's just such compelling viewing, and particularly in the cinema.
Well, he has an incredible legacy there already. Thank you both, Ken and Kevin O'Sullivan. I only need to say the surname once. Thank you both for being with us.